Good. Okay. Our topic for tonight is the Leo Frank case, which took place in 1913 through 1915. Atlanta, in the early part of the 20th century, was a changing place, a rapidly changing place. The rural folk were being crowded into a big city in the South. There were problems. There were social ills. It was child labor. And children with 60-hour work weeks, not going to school, but just slaving over in a factory. There were unsafe and unregulated workplaces where people could get hurt on the job. And paternalistic society did not look kindly upon a new situation in which Southern girls and women of virtue had to spend long hours toiling in mixed-gender factories. So, like a good Fruma Yid would say, you know, it's pasnished for there to be taruvis, so the boys and the girls together. So the Southerners, with the good Southern values, they didn't like this idea of mixed gender factories for young girls and boys. There was potential for moral corruption. The institutions of the city were not yet ready to handle the complications that emerge from a metropolitan urban life on a large scale. Granted, there was anti-Semitism. However, it should be noted that the average Gentile didn't necessarily hate his Jewish neighbor at the personal level. However, there was widespread and deep-seated prejudice against the Jewish people as a whole. This is something that's not specific to Atlanta or even the American South. It was true even in the Midwest and in the Far West, really everywhere outside of the Northeast. This notion that Jews are the worst offenders when it comes to capitalism hurting the low-level American, but you like the Jew next door because he owns the general store and gives you credit, you know, for your seed and whatever else you need. So the Jew is a nice guy, but the Jews are bad. German Jews had succeeded in assimilating or at least acculturating throughout much of the South, including in Atlanta. But the very presence and very visible presence of Eastern European, or we might say Russian Jews, aggravated the situation of Jew hatred. And in the eyes of the acculturated German Jews, the new arrivals were barbaric and ignorant and didn't have Southern charm. Many of the factory owners were Jewish, which furthered the narrative that the Yankee Jew was coming up, down from the North and doing sinister things to righteous Southerners. So that was a popular idea that was exacerbated in the Leo Frank case. Now, who was Leo Frank? Leo Frank was born in Suero, Texas, on April 17, 1884. His parents were Rudolph and Rachel Frank, who were immigrants from Central Europe. He moved to Brooklyn when he was a baby, later in 1884, and went to New York City public schools. He graduated from the Pratt Institute in 1902, and then went to Cornell University and graduated in 1906, with a degree in mechanical engineering. So he's a very well-educated young man, talented young fellow, and on the Jewish spectrum, not necessarily very frum, but was Jewishly involved and took his Jewish identity very seriously. He went to Atlanta to interview for a job in his uncle's business. His uncle was a major shareholder in the National Pencil Company, pencil manufacturer. So Leo got the job, and then went to Germany for a 9-month internship in pencil making, and then moved to Atlanta full-time in 1908. He quickly became the superintendent of the factory, earning $180 a month, plus some of the profits of the business. He married Lucille Selig, another Jew of German extraction, obviously with a name like Selig, in 1910. Her family were prominent industrialists and upper middle class Jews from Atlanta. He was a little bit more traditionally Jewish than she was, but it was a good marriage. Marriage life was happy. So that's the story of Leo Frank. In 1913, he's a 29-year-old young fellow, recently married, a macher in a business, in a pencil factory business, when his life goes terribly awry. Mary Fagan. Mary Fagan was born on June 1st, 1899. She dropped out of school at the age of 10 to start working because her family was poor. Her father died, I think, before she was born, and her mother remarried. It was a rocky family situation. In early 1912, She took a job at the National Pencil Company. What was her task? So her job was to insert rubber erasers in the metal tips of pencils. And she worked long hours. It was very difficult for her. She worked 55 hours per week, earning 10 cents per hour. So $5.50 a week, not very good. Her job was located on the second floor of the factory, and it happened to be across the hallway from Leo Frank's office. On April 21st, 1913, Mary Fagan was laid off from her job because there was a metal shortage. And so the company could not continue production of the pencils with the metal, with the eraser. So they laid her off. They had to downsize a little bit. So she wanted to get paid for the time in the last week of her term of employment. So on Saturday, April 26th at noon, she came to the factory to collect her wages of $1.20. Now that day, Saturday, April 26th, 1913, was what holiday? Who knows?
Easter.
Not Easter. No, no, no. Okay. So
Confederate
it was,
Day.
Correct. Correct. Good. So it was Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. The next day was the seventh day, the Yontif. But it was also Confederate Memorial Day, observed in the South with parades and the like. Okay, was
there... do they do that today?
My guess is Maternished. It's no longer allowed.
Okay, good.
So that in Fort Bragg will be Zichrona Livracha or Yimach Shemo, whatever it is. So it was a very important day for Southern folk who memorialized the lost cause of the Confederacy, and it was also Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. Well, Frank was not the most pious of Yid, but you know, he was at work on that day, and she came to get paid. So what happened? Newt Lee, the night watchman and a black man, found Mary Fagan's body in the basement of the factory the next morning at 3 a.m. near an incinerator. Her dress was up around her waist. She had a strip of petticoat tied around her neck. Her head was battered and bruised. Her underwear was stained and with blood and torn open. Her skin was covered with ash and dirt. There was a door leading to an alleyway that had been tampered with, and there was blood on a crowbar. All sorts of evidence is here, and the police badly mishandled some of the evidence. Very badly mishandled it. There were two murder notes, and I'm going to read them to you, and think about what these notes actually mean. So the first note said he would love me, land down play like the night witch did it, but that long, tall, black Negro did boy his slough. Then the second one says, ma'am, that Negro hired down here did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole, a long, tall Negro, black, that who is ways long, slim, tall Negro, I write while play with me. So basically gibberish, but these were notes that were written. So the question is, if these notes were to be taken not as some kind of a conspiracy, which ultimately we'll conclude they were, but rather at face value, what are these notes trying to say? Who's supposedly the author of these notes?
The black guy.
The young lady.
Okay, good. So the at the surface level, the young lady in her death throes takes out a piece of paper and pen and writes some sentences and leaves them behind for the police to find.
I hope a pencil, not a pen.
Well, it probably was a pencil, correct. With no eraser on it. Well, the notes complicate matters because it seems absurd to think that a girl in her last moments of life was really going to write this stuff down. And so how the police investigators interpreted the significance of these notes, and how the trial judge and appeals court judge and governor and Supreme Court of the United States would interpret these notes would be very important in the long run. At first, the police thought that the victim was black, because of all the soot covering her body. Then they realized that Mary Fagan was white, and they arrested Newt Lee, a black man. A trail of blood leading from the elevator indicated that Lee had moved the body. A friend of Fagan's was also arrested for murder because the police were following at that time a second theory, a different theory about what had happened. But by Monday, Newt Lee and Fagan's friend were both released. And the thinking being that they were not the perpetrators. A new theory developed that Mary was killed on the second floor of the factory because some physical evidence was found there. A hair on a lathe and a possibly blood on the floor. Leo Frank was telephoned by the police Sunday morning, and he shows up at the factory. At that time, he was not a suspect at all, yet he seemed nervous, and he was constantly rubbing his hands like this, you know. So he claimed that he did not recognize the name Mary Fagan, and he had to check the payroll to see if, in fact, she was an employee there. So on Monday, Frank's attorney provided a timeline to the police detectives regarding Leo Frank's activities on Saturday. The police checked Frank's body for cuts and bruises, and they found nothing to indicate that he was injured or was in a struggle. They also found no blood on the suit that he wore that Saturday, nor did they find any blood in the laundry at his home. But Frank realizes that the police are serious about investigating him, and that he's not just a person of interest, but he may be the prime suspect at this point. So Leo Frank hires Pinkerton detectives to try to prove his innocence. But unbeknownst to Leo Frank, one of the Pinkerton agents was named Harry Scott. And Scott's best friend was a local detective named John Black. And John Black was convinced right from the outset that Leo Frank was guilty. So the guy who he's hiring to do him a favor may end up being his worst enemy. Black went to Newt Lee's residence on Tuesday and found what looked like to be planted evidence. Like in the OJ trial, you know, planted evidence. So he interpreted this as an attempt by Leo Frank to pin the murder on Newt Lee. Frank was arrested at the factory on Tuesday, and the police assumed that Lee was Frank's accomplice, that Frank was trying to pin the crime entirely on Lee. Accusations were made that Leo Frank regularly flirted with the female employees at the business. And the public perception developed that rich Jews were bribing the police and evading prosecution by paying for private detectives. So already in the news media, there is this sentiment that why is the defendant paying for his own detectives and investigators? What's going on here? Why is a rich Jew getting away with something that anybody else wouldn't have gotten away with? So much of the case against Leo Frank was based upon the testimony of Jim Conley. Jim Conley was the factory janitor and also a black man. And as we'll eventually see, also the likely murderer, the real murderer. Conley was arrested on Thursday, May 1st, after the police saw him washing blood off of his shirt. So the police are on to everybody's trail. They're watching everybody's every move. And he washed blood off his shirt, we'll arrest the guy. He claimed that on the day of the murder, he was not at the factory, that he was busy at a saloon and shooting dice and drinking. That, in other words, he was carousing and having a good time, and he wasn't there. On May 24th, Jim Conley confessed to writing the murder notes, but he claimed that Leo Frank forced him to do it, and that Leo Frank told him to do it on Friday, the day before the murder actually happened. So the police were skeptical about Conlon's story, because that would have meant that Leo Frank was guilty of premeditation, that already the day before the murder happened, he had in mind to kill Mary Fagan, and also that he would confess ahead of time to Conley that he was going to do it. That seemed to be a bit absurd, that even if the police thought that Leo Frank was guilty, they didn't think that he would go that route. That's stupid. So Conley then admitted that he lied about meeting Leo Frank on Friday and claimed that it happened on Saturday, and that he didn't know about the murder until after it was uncovered on Monday. Conley later told a story and recanted the story about being given $200 by Frank as a bribe for his silence, but that Frank gave the money to Conley and then took it back and thought better of it. You know, I don't want to give you the money. So that $200 never really existed. That was a figment of Conley's imagination. But he told a lot of stories to the investigators, some true, some false, some a little bit false. A lot of it was just to muddy the waters and to confuse the investigators. Okay. Now, William Manning Smith, William Smith, a good name, a good American name, William Smith, was a lawyer who had a track record of getting black male clients accused of raping white women off the hook. That he had a track record of defending successfully black males accused of raping white women. But he didn't like how Conley was giving a lot of jailhouse interviews. Conley was talking too much. You know, like you see in the movies, you know, there's certain criminals, they talk too much and it ends up costing them. So on February 24th, 1914, 10 months after this all happened, Conley was sentenced to 1 year in prison for being an accomplice after the fact to the murder of Mary Fagan on the premise that he was not the murderer, that Leo Frank was, and Jim Conley was just an accomplice. Okay, so now we get to the issue of Leo Frank's trial. The mayor of Atlanta complicated matters. He criticized the police for feeding so much info to the media that it was causing public hysteria and a frenzy. The governor, mute everybody, what was that? So the governor had to form 10 militia groups in case they were needed to repulse mob action against prisoners. But Leo Frank wasn't safe in jail. And we'll see in the end, he was not safe in jail. That's how he dies. So yellow journalism, distortion, misinformation, and innuendo were creating an anxious city and a shocked state of Georgia. The working class Christian whites came to view Leo Frank as a defiler of young girls, while the Jews viewed him as an exemplary citizen and a loving husband. So it depends upon who you are. That's going to be how you view this man. Either he's a good guy or he's the worst scoundrel ever. Ordinary people had a hard time evaluating the information that they were being fed. In other words, if the news media is giving you contradictory information, a lot of it based upon nothing. So you can't blame the average citizen for just not knowing what to believe and for possibly thinking the worst. People came to strongly believe many things that were out and out falsehoods. So Hugh Dorsey was the prosecutor, and he had a problem, Dorsey. Dorsey's problem was that he just lost two very high profile cases. And if he had lost one more high profile case, he would have been fired. He would have lost his position and it would have no future political career in law enforcement. So he needed a conviction in the Fagan case, lest, you know, his future as an attorney be in mud. Well, on May 23rd, 1913, a grand jury convened to hear evidence about Leo Frank. The prosecutor promised that more evidence would be presented at trial, but that only enough evidence was presented to the grand jury to secure a true bill of indictment. And lo and behold, yes, the next day, Leo Frank was indicted. You can indict a ham sandwich. I know, I served in Westchester County on a grand jury, and every single requested indictment was granted. So over a four-week stretch that I served. So anybody could be indicted, even on almost no evidence whatsoever. Frank's team requested that Jim Conley be indicted for murder as well. And that did not happen. The jury foreman was inclined to do so, but on Dorsey's request, Conley was not indicted for murder, only as an accomplice in a trial that was held later. And I can appreciate this because when I served on a grand jury in Westchester County, there was the last case we had before we adjourned for the weekend was a case where somebody was going to be indicted, but someone lied to us on the stand in the grand jury room. And I told the assistant DA in Westchester, I want to indict that person for perjury, even though you have not requested it. And it's our prerogative as a grand jury to do so. And he told everyone, it's Friday at 2:00. Do you want to follow this guy or do you want to go home? And in the end, we all went home because they didn't want to listen to me. So I can understand how a jury foreman gets pressured by a prosecutor to do what the prosecutor wants. and they didn't indict Conley for murder. Okay. The trial began on July 28th in Fulton County Superior Court, and Judge Leonard Roan, R-O-A-N, was presiding. The prosecution was led by Hugh Dorsey, and it included William Smith, who was Conley's attorney, which is absurd. So here, what happened? The real killer's lawyer was serving on the prosecution of the guy who didn't actually commit the crime. So this procedurally, and just in terms of tzedek tirdof, sounds like the most absurd example of injustice. But so it was. Okay. Well, the hundreds of people were in attendance inside the courtroom, outside the courthouse, hanging from branches of trees, looking through the window to see inside. And this led to the intimidation of witnesses and the jury, who felt as though if they couldn't get a conviction, then people were going to get killed on the spot. Blood was going to be shed in the courtroom and in the streets. It was a case in which a Southern prosecutor was trying to convict a white man on the basis of a black man's testimony. The defense depicted Jim Conley as a new kind of Negro, dangerous, degraded, anarchic. In other words, all the negative stereotypes of an American black that in the 20th century would be held by an urban dwelling white person, especially a northerner, that was what Leo Frank's defense was, that Jim Conley is one of these bad guys, bad apples. The prosecution, however, depicted Conley as a, quote, familiar type of old Negro, meaning someone from the old South, like a minstrel singer or a plantation worker, someone who doesn't mean any harm, couldn't hurt a fly. And the familiar type, they argued, was too dumb to make up a complicated story. So whatever he's saying must actually be the truth because he's too stupid to make up a false story. So here you have two very different stereotypes of the American black man, each one going in a different direction. One saying he's a dangerous killer. The other saying, he's a kindly old nothing, but he's too dumb to make up a story. So each stereotype serves a purpose. One is to defend Leo Frank and the other is to convict Leo Frank. Okay. Now, Frank, it was argued, used Conley to pin the crime on Newt Lee, the night watchman. The defense claimed that Conley murdered Fagan in the course of a robbery and that Lee helped Conley write the murder notes. The prosecution focused on Leo Frank's sexual behavior, and current employees all testified that they never saw Leo Frank flirt with anyone. However, former employees were brought out of the woodwork to besmirch his reputation. The timeline of the events was disputed. The accusation against Leo Frank would have required 30 minutes to perpetrate between the killing, the dragging of the girl to the basement, and whatever else needed to be done. And yet Frank's whereabouts on that day were accounted for other than for a brief period between 12:02 p.m. and 12:20 p.m., which was not enough time to commit the crime. So the defense argued, hey, he couldn't have done it because we know where he was. There are witnesses to see where he was. You have this small window of opportunity, but that's not a big enough window for him to do what the prosecution says he did. Okay. The prosecution claimed that the defense was guilty of bribery and witness tampering, and maybe even jury tampering. The defense wanted a mistrial because of intimidation. The judge and the defense team agreed that for Frank's own defense and that of his lawyer's physical defense, that they would not be present when the verdict was announced. So the verdict was announced and Leo Frank and his lawyers were not in the room. The thinking being, if they were in the room and there was an acquittal, he'd be lynched right on the spot. And if he were in the room and there was a guilty verdict, he might also be lynched on the spot. Okay? So he wasn't present. After 4 hours of deliberating, the jury came up with a unanimous guilty verdict on August 25th, 1913. So 4 hours to decide, 12 to nothing, guilty. Dorsey was carried out of the courthouse triumphantly on people's shoulders, like he was a chassan at a wedding. You know, they hoisted him up in the air. Hooray, hooray, he convicted the Jew. On August 26th, Judge Roan sentenced Leo Frank to be executed by hanging on October 10th. The defense argued that public opinion had unconsciously influenced the jury to the prejudice of Leo Frank. So now we get to the appeals process. And this is going to be a lengthy appeals process because, after all, nobody wants to get executed. So the first appeal was to Judge Roan himself, the trial judge. And the defense had to, in this instance, offer objections on the basis of trial procedure, not the analysis of the evidence. That was state law in Georgia at the time, that the first appeal is to the trial judge on the basis of procedural issues. The defense wrote a long excursus with 115 points about what went wrong with the trial. Well, Roan rejected the appeal on October 31st, 1913, and he wrote the following. He said, "I am not thoroughly convinced that Leo Frank is guilty or innocent, but I do not have to be convinced. The jury has to be convinced, and there is no room to doubt that," meaning that the rules are the rules. The jury decides, I don't decide. And as long as they were convinced that he was guilty, then that's it. And he was convinced that the jury was convinced. In other words, if they vote 12-0 after 4 hours, and they don't seem to be waffling or hesitating or showing any signs of internal dissent, then what's done is done. Okay. Well, the appeal then went to the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia. And it took place on December 15th, 1913. And the ruling was handed down on February 17th, 1914, against Frank by a decision of 4-2. The dissenting judges thought that a new trial ought to be granted because the talk of Frank's sexual past had no bearing on the Fagan case and prejudiced the jury against him. So they're acknowledging that the prosecution in the course of the trial basically brought out all this lashon hara and schmutz on Frank, whether true or false, that did not have any bearing on the case. So even if true, it was inappropriate to bring it up at the trial, and that poisoned the jury, so therefore you need a new trial. Okay. But that was a minority viewpoint. By 4-2, they said, appeals denied. So a new execution date was set for April 17th, 1914. There was one more appeal made to the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia based upon new evidence previously unknown during the jury trial. And what was this new evidence? Well, a few pieces of information. One was a scientific laboratory analysis of the item found on the second floor that supposedly had a hair on it, to say that the hair didn't belong to Mary Fagan. Also, witnesses repudiated their testimony between the time of the trial and the time of the appeal. Also, there were new theories by experts on the legitimacy of the murder notes. And lastly, there were letters written by Jim Conley while he was in prison that strongly implied that he was the real murderer. Now, bear in mind, Jim Conley is an idiot, okay? And he probably really was the murderer. And he was talking too much even before he was convicted. And his own lawyer knew he was talking too much. And in letters written from jail, he basically confessed. So all this was mitigating, you know, factors against Frank's conviction and reasons why an appeals court might be inclined to grant a new trial or to throw out the conviction altogether. So another thing that was thrown in was a federal issue that Leo Frank was not present at the moment of his conviction. And so therefore, as a matter of due process, his rights were violated. Louis Marshall of the American Jewish Committee participated in the appeal. The American Jewish Committee did not, as an organization, make any significant statements on the case, but individual members of the executive committee of the American Jewish Committee, as individuals, contributed to Leo Frank's defense fund and wrote op-ed pieces in various newspapers. Okay. On November 14th, 1914, the judge in the Supreme Court of Georgia upheld the lower court's ruling and determined that any due process complaints, even if they were valid, were being raised too late. That they should have been raised a lot earlier. Should have been raised much earlier. So therefore, it's too late, can't do it now. Well, the next step was to appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States of America, SCOTUS. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., noted that the due process issue was, in fact, too late to be raised. However, on the merits, he believed and wrote, "I very seriously doubt if the petitioner has had due process of law because of the trial taking place in the presence of a hostile demonstration and seemingly dangerous crowd thought by the presiding judge to be ready for violence unless a guilty verdict was rendered." So here, Oliver Wendell Holmes is saying, really, this was unfair. And the jury was prejudiced, and the courtroom environment was not conducive for real justice. On April 15th, 1915, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled 7-2 against Leo Frank in the famous case of Frank versus Mangum. The dissenters were Oliver Wendell Holmes and Charles Evans Hughes. And Charles Evans Hughes wrote for the dissenters, quote, "It is our duty to declare lynch law as little valid when practiced by a regularly drawn jury as when administered by one elected by a mob intent on death." Now, there's a certain foreshadowing here because Charles Evans Hughes is writing this in April. 4 months later, in fact, the lynch mob would kill Leo Frank. So what Charles Evans Hughes is saying is that there's no legitimacy to a lynch law, you know, to a group of people making themselves out to be, you know, deputized, self-deputized, that we're going to take the law into our own hands and kill the guy who deserves to be killed. Well, that's bogus. You can't do that. And if it happens inside of an official courtroom, but the environment is such is that it's the same craziness, well, that's just as illegitimate. That's what the dissenting views in the Supreme Court had to say. Well, now that SCOTUS had prepared on things, is Leo Frank doomed? What other options does he have to spare his life? So the answer,
governor.
What was that?
The governor.
The governor, right, correct. Okay, so before we get to the governor, there's one more stage. You go back to the state of Georgia, and on April 22nd, 1915, there was a commutation hearing at the Georgia Prison Commission. So maybe the prison commission, forget the governor, just the board of three commissioners might be willing to reduce the sentence from a death penalty to something less than that, maybe life imprisonment, who knows what. So it was rejected on June 9th, 1915 by a vote of 2-1. So one more vote and he would have had his life spared. What the dissenter noted was it felt wrong to execute a man on the testimony of an accomplice when the circumstances of the crime tend to fix guilt upon the accomplice. In other words, two guys look guilty here, but the one who's more guilty is Jim Conley. And Jim Conley's testifying against Leo Frank, and Leo Frank is going to die, and Conley's not going to die. So how's that fair? It's not fair. Therefore, commute the sentence. But that was the dissenting viewpoint, the 2-1. The two win, and so Leo Frank is set to be executed. So now it was in the hands of the governor, the governor. The governor was John Slayton. And John Slayton's term was actually about to expire 4 days after the execution date for Frank. So he has to act fast. And what are there going to be the political consequences for him potentially letting Frank die versus sparing his life? So the further wrinkle to this was that John Slayton was a law partner with Luther Rosser. Luther Rosser was Leo Frank's lead attorney. So when Slayton will eventually issue a commutation, everyone who opposed it said, conflict of interest, you know, how could you, this is totally bogus. So Slayton reviewed the matter on June 12th, 1915. And he had in front of him all sorts of amicus briefs and documents from people who were in favor of the execution, from people who opposed the execution. One very important piece of information that Governor Slayton had was a document by Judge Roan, the original trial judge, who had at that point died, but on his deathbed had written a little note to the governor saying, "Governor, please correct my error, that I feel I was wrong in sentencing to death this Leo Frank. It's in your hands now to right this injustice." Slayton, however, also received a lot of death threats, thousands of death threats. insisting that he has to hang Leo Frank. Alternatively, you know, there's the carrot and the stick. The stick was, if you don't hang Leo Frank, we'll kill you. The carrot was, if you hang Leo Frank, we'll arrange for you to become a United States senator. Bear in mind, Slayton was a governor whose term was expiring, and his political future was unknown. It could go in any direction or no direction. And at that time, how were United States senators installed in office?
The state legislature.
Correct. It was before the passage of the 17th Amendment. So state legislatures would vote to install U.S. senators, not by popular vote of the citizenry of the state. So if the machers in the that held a majority in the state legislature said to Slayton, we'll make you a senator if you kill the Jew, well, that's it's a temptation to kill the Jew. Okay. Well, Slayton wasn't convinced of Frank's guilt because of questions about the movement of the body and the murder notes. So on the question of the murder notes, the governor raised a very important point. He said the notes were in the third person, but they really were supposed to be the dying words of a murdered person. They should have been written in the first person, not the third person. Now, that's an egregious mistake, that a person who's trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the investigators might make, but a stupid person would make that mistake. A smart person would not make that mistake. So therefore, in the eyes of the governor, that blunder about the composition of the murder notes was something that a sweeper, a janitor might make, like Jim Conley, but an Ivy League educated manager like Leo Frank would not blunder in that obvious a fashion. So that was evidence for him that Leo Frank didn't write the notes and wasn't the killer. Okay. The notes were written on dated order pads, which testimony proved was only kept in the basement and not on the second floor of the building. Even Jim Conley's lawyer was convinced that Frank was innocent, and he wrote on behalf of Leo Frank to Governor Slayton. So this is a very bizarre thing. The guy who was serving a year in prison for accomplice after the fact, but who everyone really thought was the actual murderer, his lawyer is writing to the governor to commute the sentence of the guy committed, who was convicted of committing the murder, but who really didn't. So it's a real bizarre permutation here. In the end, Governor Slayton on June 21st decided to commute the sentence to life imprisonment. Life imprisonment. Atlanta Mayor Jimmy Woodward noted that most of the population thought that Frank was guilty and that the commutation was a horrible mistake. Governor Slayton invited the media, invited the press corps to his home, and he tried to impress upon the citizenry of Georgia that don't let your prejudices and your feelings get in the way of clouding your judgment. Look at the facts reasonably, and you'll come to the conclusion that my commutation of Frank was very reasonable and correct. So it's an appeal to people's better judgment, that they shouldn't be, you know, Vildachayas wanting blood out of prejudice, but rather look at the facts. Okay, so he said, feeling as I do about this case, I would be a murderer if I allowed this man to hang. Slayton privately told people that he would have issued a full pardon, except that he fully anticipated Frank's defense team to be able to prove their client's innocence in the near term. So he downgraded the sentence from execution to life imprisonment, supposedly thinking there was going to be a release of Frank from incarceration soon, because enough evidence was going to come out that he really was not guilty. And better it come out as evidence than as a pardon, a governor's pardon. Okay. After the commutation was issued, a mob threatened Governor Slayton's home. The governor deputized a bunch of his friends to chase away the mob, and Slayton and his wife fled Georgia not to return for a long while. So the governor was basically run out of his own state for commuting the sentence of a Jew convicted of murder. Was moved to Milledgeville State Penitentiary for his protection even before the commutation was issued. On before June 17th, and the commutation was June 21st, they moved him way out of town. So Milledgeville Prison was more than 150 miles away from Marietta, Georgia. Now, Marietta, Georgia is relevant because that was Mary Fagan's hometown. And all the ones who were real riled up to kill Leo Frank were the ones from Marietta because they wanted to avenge the death of their fellow citizen. So the road leading from Marietta to Milledgeville Penitentiary not only was 150 miles a trip, but it was not a paved road. It was a dirt road. So it wasn't easy to get from point A to point B. And that was the whole point, to make sure that the vigilantes don't come and grab Leo Frank out of prison. Well, that was the intention, but yet the safeguards were insufficient. So what happened to Leo Frank? Well, already on June 17th, shortly after he gets to Milledgeville Penitentiary, a fellow inmate named William Crean slashed Leo Frank's neck trying to kill him. So why did he do it? Well, a few reasons. One was because William Crean and other inmates at that penitentiary thought that they were in mortal danger of mob violence burning down the facility in an attempt to do vigilante justice against Leo Frank. So long as this guy is a fellow inmate of ours, we're all in danger because they could burn down the place, the mob. So better we should kill him first and get rid of the danger to ourselves. Secondly, William Crean and others in the jail thought that Leo Frank was a dirty Jew and guilty of committing a murder of a Christian girl. So he was happy to kill the guy. And thirdly, William Crean was convinced that if in fact he slashed Leo Frank and killed him, that he would be pardoned by the authorities for the act of murder because everybody wanted Leo Frank dead anyway. So these were the reasons why William Crean was willing and able to attack a fellow inmate. But Frank didn't die. He had a gash in his neck, but he lived. Okay, so he lived, but only for two more months. In August, the Knights of Mary Fagan, no, Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, so then like the Knights of Pythias, Knights of Mary Fagan, was a lynch mob that was created to get justice and to kill Leo Frank. It was led by former Georgia governor Joseph Mackey Brown, and other members were prominent politicians and sheriffs from Marietta, Georgia. So these were not like drunken hoodlums and nobodies looking to kill somebody. These were high-ranking public officials and former public officials with judicial and executive authority out for just for vigilante justice as they saw it. On August 16th, they drove all the way from Marietta to Milledgeville Prison. They abducted Frank and drove him back to Marietta, where they executed him by hanging the next morning on August 17th. His body was discovered at 7 a.m., and huge crowds came to see the dead Jew. People took souvenirs by cutting off parts of Leo Frank's shirt and even pieces of the tree branch on which he was hanged. So, like, you know, when they destroy an old stadium and people take a chair or a piece of the foul pole or a piece of chunk of the grass, bigoted Southerners who hated the Jews were taking pieces of physical remnants of the Leo Frank lynching. Okay, the mob voted almost unanimously with one dissenter to allow someone to recover Leo Frank's body and give him a dignified burial. One person wanted to mutilate the corpse and incinerate it on the spot, but he was voted down. So Leo Frank's corpse was recovered, taken to New York, and he was buried at Mount Carmel Cemetery in Glendale, Queens, you know, in the Cypress Hills area. And I've been to his grave. About a year or two ago, I did a funeral at Mount Carmel Cemetery, and I decided, you know, I know Leo Frank is buried here. I went to the office to get the instructions about how to, you know, where is it? Where is the tombstone? And I found it. It's a very simple, plain tombstone. You could see, if you go on Google Images, Leo Frank tombstone, you could see it. A very, very, very sad situation. Okay. Well, the names of the people involved were very well known locally, meaning I gave you the name of a former governor and said other local officials were involved. So locally, people knew who did it. But officially, nobody knew. Nicht wissendig. And there were no indictments filed. No charges. No one was ever prosecuted for killing Leo Frank. In the year 2000, did the names of the people in the lynch party get revealed, because Mary Fagan's great niece published an article about it and revealed the names. This is about 20 years ago. After Frank was lynched, photos were taken of his dead body hanging from the tree, and thousands of postcards were manufactured and sold and traded among bigoted Southerners with the picture of Leo Frank's dead body hanging from the tree. So much so that the state of Georgia had to license the vendors selling the postcards because it was so popular, and taxed them on it. Okay. Well, the headline in the major newspaper, the Jeffersonian, that came out after the lynching said the following: "Committee redeems Georgia and carries out the sentence of the law on the Jew who raped and murdered the little Gentile girl, Mary Fagan. Slayton was Frank's lawyer, and the commutation was void. In putting the sodomite murderer to death, the vigilant committee has done what the sheriff would have done if Slayton had not been in the same mold as Benedict Arnold. Let the Jewish libertines take notice. Georgia is not for sale to rich criminals." So here, Tom Watson, the publisher of the Jeffersonian, is getting out all the bigotry he can. But as he calls Slayton a Benedict Arnold, he accuses him of being Leo Frank's lawyer, which wasn't true. There was a connection between Frank's lawyer and Slayton's law firm, but he wasn't Frank's lawyer. And the Jews are all a bunch of libertines. Southerners are pure and virtuous and don't commit sex crimes, but the dirty Jews do. And the Jews are a bunch of criminals and rich. So that was, you know, popular sentiment after the fact. Well, the Anti-Defamation League was established in 1913 by the B'nai B'rith, in part because of the Leo Frank case. After the lynching, nearly half of Georgia's 3,000 Jews left the state. They were scared. They were legitimately scared. Jews in Georgia who remained became even more assimilated and Episcopalian-looking, hoping not to stand out. Among the non-Orthodox, weddings no longer involved a chuppah because it looked too Jewish. You don't want to even give the slightest impression in a public setting that you're a Yid. There was an attempt to pardon Leo Frank posthumously, but it failed in 1982. There was a second attempt in 1986, and it was successful. There is an anti-lynching memorial stone at the official Leo Frank Memorial Site in Marietta, Georgia, and Congressman John Lewis of blessed memory was involved a few years ago in making that happen on the 100th anniversary. So comparisons are made between the Leo Frank case and two other cases that happened around exactly the same time. What are those cases? What am I talking about?
Dreyfus.
Dreyfus and Bayless. So we spent a whole session maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, discussing Bayless, for those of you who remember. And I don't think we've ever had a full session on Dreyfus. I think last year we discussed it only in the context of Theodore Herzl's journalistic coverage of the Dreyfus affair and how that either did or didn't affect his evolution towards Zionism. But I don't think we ever handled the Dreyfus case in total. So are they analogous? The answer is a little bit yes, a little bit no. In the case of Dreyfus, so he was convicted and he was sentenced to, you know, to some term imprisonment and lost his standing in the military. He was embarrassed with the ceremony where they broke his sword and so on and so forth. But in the end, courtesy of Emil Zola and others, Dreyfus was let go. He was pardoned and he lived to see another day. He was born in 1859. His bad episode was 1894, but he was let out of jail eventually in 1906 and lived till 1935. So he had a relatively long life and lived to be exonerated. So Mendel Bayless was tried and was not convicted by a very close vote in a courtroom in Kiev. He was not convicted of murder. And then what happened? He left Russia and came to the United States. His material circumstances were not good, and in the end, he had to survive doing appearances as like a D-list celebrity at Catskill hotels in the 1920s and early 30s. That's how he made a parnassa. Essentially, I'm Mendel Bayliss. You know, meet Mendel Bayliss. But he died in 1934. So Dreyfus and Bayliss lived full lives. Leo Frank was horribly killed at the age of 31, and certainly did not know that in the long run he'd be pardoned. So there's Asher mentions in the chat that Leo Frank served a stint as B'nai B'rith Lodge president. That is correct. He was the chapter president of the Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, which is why the Jewish organizations were interested in defending him, or at least behind the scenes defending him, just because he was a Jew being falsely accused, or at least it was seen as he was being falsely accused. But in addition, he was involved in Jewish affairs. Okay, so the non-Jews who wanted Frank's death, Leo Frank's death, they had various songs, ballads that they sang at the protest rallies, praying and hoping for his execution. And I want to read to you the most famous of those. This was the Ballad of Mary Fagan, which was made popular by Fiddling John Carson at demonstrations throughout Georgia in the spring and summer of 1915, prior to Frank's execution. So it goes like this. I'll read it to you. Little Mary Fagan, she left her home one day. She went to the pencil factory to get her little pay. She left her home at 11. She kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Leo Frank, he met her with a brutish heart, we know. He smiled and said, little Mary, you won't go home no more. Sneaked along behind her till she reached the metal room. He laughed and said, little Mary, you have met your fatal doom. Down to Leo Frank she pled. He had taken a stick from the trash pile and struck her across the head. Tears flow down her rosy cheeks while the blood flows down her back. Remembered telling her mother what time she would be back. You killed little Mary Fagan. It was on one holiday. Called for old Jim Conley to carry her body away. He'd taken her to the basement. She was bound both hand and feet. Down in the basement, the little Mary, she did sleep. Newtley was a watchman who went to wind his key. Down in the basement, little Mary he did see. Went in and called the officers, whose names I do not know. Come to the factory, said Newtley, you must go. Taking him to the jailhouse, they locked him in a cell. Poor old innocent Negro knew nothing for to tell. Have a notion in my head, when Frank he comes to die, stand examination in a courthouse in the sky. Come all you jolly people, wherever you may be. Suppose little Mary Fagan belonged to you or me. Now little Mary's mother, she weeps and mourns all day, praying to meet her little Mary in a better world someday. Now little Mary's in heaven, Leo Frank's in jail, waiting for the day to come when he can tell his tale. Frank will be astonished when the angels come to say, you killed little Mary Fagan, it was on one holiday. Judge, he passed the sentence, then he reared back. If he hang Leo Frank, it won't bring little Mary back. Frank, he's got little children, and they'll want for bread. Look up at their papa's picture, say, now my papa's dead. Judge, he passed the sentence. He reared back in his chair. He will hang Leo Frank and give the Negro a year. Next time he passed the sentence, you bet he passed it well. Solicitor Hugh Manson Dorsey sent Leo Frank to hell. So that was the ballad. Now, if you notice in this ballad, there are a few themes. One, the Christian virtue of Mary Fagan, and for that matter, the rest of the white populace in the South, and the sort of the sinister character of the Jew. The other is, the idea that the Negro is not the devil, but rather the Negro was being used by the Jew to further his sinister plot, and was like a patsy in the whole thing. So it's a very interesting phenomenon that the bigoted South had various groups that they didn't like. They didn't like blacks, and they didn't like Jews. Well, which one are they going to like even less, or rather, I should say, hate even more? And in this instance, the hatred of the Jew overrode the hatred of the black man. And so the interpretation of Conley and Lee's behavior is to say, they were just fools, pawns in a game by the sinister Jew. Also, this idea of Mary Fagan went to heaven, and there's nothing we can do to bring her back. So the idea that the judge or the authorities might be disinclined to kill somebody because, after all, how does the death of one person bring back another person? It doesn't. But nonetheless, he was sentenced and he's going to be executed and he'll be sent to hell. That's the idea of the Ballad of Mary Fagan. Okay. Now, there was a comment in the chat. In 1982, Alonzo Mann, who was an office boy in the pencil factory, confirmed the Conley was the murderer. And turned to kill him if he ever told the truth. Right. So it's true. Yes. Alonzo Mann did come forward many, many years later. And that testimony was used in the hearings before the Board of Pardons in the 1980s that eventually resulted in the pardon of Leo Frank. So there really isn't that much ambiguity anymore about what happened. Conley killed Mary Fagan, and unfortunately Leo Frank got roped into it and died for it. Eli's asking in the chat, how did the Northern Jew play a part in the case? So that's a good question. What made Leo Frank so detested by the population of Atlanta, and for that matter, the population of Marietta, Georgia? So in part, it's he's a Jew. In part, it's because he's a Northerner. In part, it's because he's educated. In part, it's because he's wealthy, or rather is associated with wealth because his uncle owned the business and he had a fancy job. And in part, it's because he just dressed the part of a more cultured person. So a Northern Jew of education, of financial means, and of culture is the antithesis of sort of the slack-jawed yokel of the South in every way. So which of these pieces of the puzzle was the most important? Was it the Jew angle? Was it the education? Was it the money? Was it the sectional animus of North versus South? It's hard to know, and it doesn't really matter. They all worked against Leo Frank's favor and led to his ultimate demise.
Do you know what happened to Frank's family?
His wife never remarried. I know that.
But was he haughty? Was he? He did not stay above the fray. He was involved in the community, so that should have been a positive, attractive dimension to.
Well, I don't think that Leo Frank had too many detractors before the Mary Fagan case developed. Most likely, whoever knew him thought he was a decent guy, and most people didn't know him because he's just your average citizen. But once he achieved certain renown, or rather, dubious renown for being an accused murderer, so then all of his cultural stripes work against him in that environment. It's unclear that he had any real detractors before this episode happened.
It may indicate that nobody is fully immune from microscopic examination and the persistence of negative publicity on a drumbeat, every
yes,
day.
So the moral of the story here is that the population of a city, of a state, of a region can be inflamed and can lead to believe that someone was guilty of some horrific crime, even in the absence of any real evidence to that effect, because the drumbeat is there.
Yellow journalism. I don't know if you mentioned Hearst.
So William Hearst's newspapers,
yeah,
favored Leo Frank. They actually sided with him with his defense. It was the other newspapers, the Journal Constitution and a few other, the Jeffersonian, who thought lowly of Frank and wanted him convicted and spun every little piece of information against him. Now, what's interesting, however, is Northern newspapers also took up the story. It's natural that the local newspapers in the South and in the state of Georgia would have an interest in the case. But even Northern newspapers in New York and in Boston started covering it in late 1913 during the appeals process, not during the trial in Fulton County Court. But once the appeals process was advancing to Georgia State Supreme Court and then to the United States Supreme Court, then newspapers around the country had an interest in it. And of course, the further you got away from the bigoted South, the less likely it was for a newspaper to skew the coverage totally against Frank, you know, unfairly. So there was regional distinctions in newspaper coverage.
I think there's a movie on this case.
There are multiple movies and books. I think the name of the book, well, one of them is the Mary Fagan case.
By Alfred Ury called Parade, and it was on Broadway.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So, Rabbi, time for one more question, yeah.
I really feel that it wasn't that much after the Civil War, which was very bitter. There was bitterness between the North and the South. So the fact that I came from the North as a Yankee played a lot into it.
It certainly did.
A lot into it. And because, now if you look at it in a very more sober way, to me, Connolly was, he was a suspect. I mean, why would they pin it? What was his motive? What would they say his motive was? Unless they put a Christian overtone, a Jewish-like Christian blood.
Maybe that's so it's interesting. We don't find in the accusations leveled against Leo Frank that he did it because of some religious motivation or some theological motivation, like, you know, he needs blood for matzah baking. That we don't find. However,
Baylis, you do.
Well, so in other cases, that was true. Baylis, you know, it was blood for Pesach. But in Leo Frank case, the accusation was more that lascivious Jewish males are preying upon innocent Christian girls, and that this was a theme not just for this case, but for many cases of, you know, the accusation of the sexual predator Jewish male, and it was very easy to convince people of that, as opposed to Connolly, who there may have been some sexual angle to his attack on Mary Fagan, in fact, but more likely he just wanted to rob her because he knew she was getting paid that day, and he was a janitor. He wanted her money. She was an easy target, but she died in the process. So
that's more logical to me.
That's much more logical than Frank. I mean, Frank, the idea that he would commit an act of sexual violence and then kill an employee in the middle of the day while at work doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay.
But you know what? Also, when he was thrown into prison, to me.
Yeah.
That was the death sentence. Most because those prisons in those days.
There was no way he was getting out alive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That to me is not a commutation. You know.
You're right.
I mean, it's a death by a different name.
That's true. We got to stop here. I'll see everybody next week. Take care.
All right. Be well. Bye.